joining us. I'm Diane Reim. The European Union came to the rescue Sunday with a pledge of nearly $1 trillion, this in hopes of stopping the credit crisis that began in Greece from spreading. Investors in Europe and the U.S. initially responded positively, but many say the pledge only postpones an inevitable day of reckoning. Joining me here in the studio to talk about Europe's credit crisis, Domenico Lombardi of the Brookings Institution, and David Smick. He's a macroeconomic consultant and editor of the International Economy magazine. Joining us by phone from London, Simon Tilford. He's chief economist at the Center for European Reform. Throughout the hour, I do invite your calls, questions. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or Twitter. First, joining us by phone from Madrid is Tom Gelton. He is, of course, a regular person on our Friday News Roundup. He's a correspondent with NPR. Good morning to you, Tom.
Good morning, Diane.
The market reactions were certainly initially positive, but there are now new questions. Let's start with where this nearly $1 trillion is coming from.
Well, the $1 trillion doesn't even really exist yet, Diane. What it basically is are numbers. They are guarantees that should these loans to governments, possibly banks, become necessary, that the individual countries that make up the eurozone, that use the euro as their currency, are each willing, say they're willing, to back up those loans, to guarantee those loans. That amounts to about $500 billion right there between those commitments. Then about $80 billion would come from the European Commission itself, and then the IMF would back up the rest of the loans. So this is a potential stabilization fund from which loans could be made, assuming that the countries are all good for what they've committed to support.
And, of course, that's the real question, isn't it, Tom? That is, to what extent the countries who have agreed to put forward these commitments can actually keep them.
That's precisely right. That's one of the big questions. I mean, all of these countries in Europe, to one extent or another, have their own budget pressures to deal with. I mean, they're all looking at growth figures that aren't what they'd like them to be. They're all looking at fiscal deficits of one side or another. And, you know, it's easy enough to make these commitments in the heat of the moment when you've got a market collapse behind you and another one looming over you. There was a sense of desperation in Brussels over the weekend. Something had to be done that was big enough to impress the markets, you know, but whether there's anything more to that commitment, we just won't know.
Now, you started with Greece. Greece had the big problem. Now, to what extent can we be assured that Greece will live up to its own commitments of belt tightening?
Well, Diane, you know, I don't even think it's a question of whether Greece is willing to live up to its commitments as far as belt tightening or growth, cutting down the size of its fiscal deficit. I think it's a question of whether Greece is capable of meeting those targets. For it to bring its fiscal deficit down, it needs to grow, but it can't grow if it's got unemployment, if it's got a big unemployment unemployment to deal with, if it's going to be, if the government budget is going to be drained by unemployment benefits. You know, it's just hard to see how these numbers add up so that Greece can make the debt payments that it is still obligated to make and bring down its deficit to the point where it could actually grow in a sustained manner. I mean, it's just, the numbers are just overwhelming. And I think the consensus, at least of people that I've spoken to, Diane, is that Greece still, even in the aftermath of this big rescue package, is still likely to have to either default on those debt obligations or perhaps find a way to get out of the Eurozone.
Well, are you saying then that this pledged $1 trillion is simply a way to buy time?
Well, it certainly is that as a minimum, as a way to buy time. Now, you know, theoretically, I think one of the things that they're looking for is to what they say, what they call ring fence Greece. So even if Greece were a couple years from now to default or to pull out of the Eurozone, it wouldn't sink all these other economies. I mean, this rescue package was aimed as much at stabilizing prospects for Spain and Portugal, Ireland. You know, it's the fear of contagion that really motivated this. So even if Greece were to go down this path, you know, I think that the rescue package would have served the purpose if the other governments were stabilized. And these countries cannot count on getting loans from this fund unless they meet very strict criteria. So, you know, implicitly here, there's a threat hanging over these countries that they've got to get their budget act together if they want to have the protection, the assurances of these loans in the background.
Tom Gelton, he's a correspondent for NPR. He's the author of the book titled Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. Thank you for joining us, Tom.
Always a pleasure, Diane.
Thank you. And turning to you now, Domenico Lombardi, you've talked about the euro as the only global currency not backed by political will. What do you mean by that?
Yes, exactly. The euro is the only global currency with no central political authority. And this is what financial markets, in a way, have spotted and are trying to profit from. We have seen that with reference to Greece. It has taken weeks, months for the Europeans to come together and provide a substantial package. It has taken months for the Europeans to assemble this package to which Tom was referring to. However, as big the number might seem, is not enough to guarantee to immunize the euro area from contagion. It would barely cover Portugal, Spain, Ireland, should these countries be fully hit by the crisis. And finally, as Tom was pointing out, much of this 500 billion euros is so far on paper. Essentially, the bulk of this sum will have to be borrowed. And clearly, it's going to take weeks, if not months, for this spot of money to become readily available, should any country on top of Greece need any stabilization program. Also, the conditions surrounding the availability of this money are not at all clear. The European finance ministers were talking about this money becoming available under exceptional circumstances, but there is no operational definition of what these exceptional circumstances might be. Ideally, to reassure markets, you may want to use this money as a preemptive strike to fund precautionary arrangements before it gets too late, as unfortunately it has been the case with Greece.
Domenico Lombardi of the Brookings Institution, turning to you, David Smick. The package that was designed, we've heard the word shock and awe to try to really make a huge impact in what's going on. Does the amount, do you agree with Domenico that the amount perhaps does not cover the real risk?
Well, I think there's the fundamental question about some other issues as well that are undermining what's going on. This situation reminds me, watching the European officials yesterday, reminds me of George Bush on the aircraft carrier proclaiming mission accomplished. I watched that and I thought, boy, this is the hubris now of thinking this is going to work. The biggest problem right now is that the austerity measures that are being demanded of these economies are so extreme that there's no way, as Tom earlier indicated, that they're going to make the numbers work. For example, there was an earlier package, you know, several weeks ago to bail out Greece. The austerity demanded by the rest of Europe, particularly the Germans, was so onerous that what they had to do, I read an analyst who went back and said that the conditions demanded by the Germans in 1931 and 32, that is the austere conditions that led to the rise of Hitler, are modest compared to what we were asking of the Greeks.
But, of course, economic conditions have changed dramatically.
No, I understand. I understand. The biggest problem, you know, the obvious answer to what's going on in Europe is to have the banks, have the bondholders take a haircut. That is, they give up some of the value of those bonds.
David Smick, he's chair and CEO of macroeconomic advisory firm Johnson Smick International. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear from Simon Tilford at the Center for European Reform. And we're back talking about the pledge from the European Union that came on Sunday, nearly $1 trillion in hopes of stopping the credit crisis that began in Greece from spreading. I have three guests, Domenico Lombardi of the Brookings Institution, David Smick, he's editor of the International Economy magazine, and on the line with us from London, Simon Tilford. He's chief economist at the Center for European Reform. Simon, I wonder how you would describe this package that the European Union has at least on paper agreed to. Is it sufficient? Will it stop the spread of these great debt concerns?
Good morning. I think there's a risk of us all agreeing with one another. I think even assuming the package is approved and the money found, and these are very big assumptions given the strength of opposition in many Eurozone economies to any kind of bailout, it will not satisfy the markets for very long because it doesn't address the underlying issue, which is the terrible growth prospects of various Eurozone economies, Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy,
and
Ireland.
Why is that?
It doesn't address, what this package would provide a temporary solution in that it's basically a liquidity package. And it basically suggests the problem is a liquidity one rather than a solvency one. The underlying problem is that these economies face formidable obstacles to a return to economic growth. The EU seems to be suggesting that if only the markets would give these economies space, it's possible for them to pull off the adjustment that's been demanded of them. And the rhetoric we're seeing from the EU is all about the markets. It's a case of preventing speculative attacks on the euro, of giving a clear signal to the markets that the euro will be defended, even talking of keeping wolves from the gate. The subtext is that the markets are overreacting and that investors are essentially conjuring up a crisis so that they can profit from it. I think so. Basically, they're basing the package on a false premise. One of the reasons why these economies can't grow is because we've seen the emergence of huge macroeconomic imbalances within the eurozone. So they're running very, very big current account or trade deficits. Now, they need to close those deficits if they have any chance of generating the necessary economic growth to put their public finances on a sustainable footing.
And how optimistic are you that they can actually accomplish that?
Well, it's very hard to see how, because what they basically need is a big devaluation. An economy in Greece's position with such a big trade deficit, with such weak public finances, would normally be accompanying this kind of austerity with a very big devaluation of its currency, probably in the order of about 40%. What is being asked of Greece at the moment is pretty much a recipe for slump and deflation. And clearly, if the economy enters slump and deflation follows, they have no chance whatsoever of putting their public finances on a sustainable footing, because obviously that will become self-defeating. If they cut spend, they won't be able to cut spending quicker than the economy contracts, essentially. And deflation will push up the real value of their debt. And because they're so highly indebted, that could prove lethal. What they really need is a big external stimulus to offset budget cuts and falls in wages. Now, in short, they need exports to grow much more rapidly than imports for a very lengthy period of time. This is highly unlikely. As I say, they can't devalue. Basically, they have to become more price competitive relative to the rest of the eurozone. Now, it's possible to cut costs relative to the rest of the currency block. For example, Germany and the Netherlands managed to do that and have seen a strong rise in their exports to the rest of the currency block. But of course, that's not something all economies can do simultaneously. That's the recipe for slump and deflation across the eurozone as a whole. If every country cuts wages and tries to boost exports and sort of allow a rising trade surplus to offset stagnant domestic demand, that's not something everyone can do. Also, it needs to be borne in mind that the Germans and the Dutch cut costs relative to the rest of the eurozone at a time when costs in places like Spain and France and Italy were rising quite rapidly. It's one thing to cut costs when other people's costs are rising quite rapidly. It's another thing to cut costs relative to the other economies when costs are stagnant or falling. So I think there's no doubt that Greece's economic management has unquestionably been profligate. The country squandered the decline in borrowing costs that came with joining the single currency. But the medicine that Germany and the other rather stronger member states are prescribing for the struggling eurozone economies will not solve their problems.
Simon Tilford, he's chief economist at the Center for European Reform. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. David Smick, there are an awful lot of people throughout Europe who blame the U.S. for the beginning of the entire crisis with our economic meltdown because of the mortgage problems. How connected, how similar do you see the two situations?
Well, I think that the dirty little secret behind the European mess today is that the European banks have been hiding debt on their balance sheets. The European banks have engaged in a giant fudge, so to speak. If you look at we talked about it 6 months ago, the East European debt, the Baltic debt. They're carrying huge toxic waste on those balance sheets and practicing a policy of forbearance. And I think one of the reasons they can't get out of this mess is that the logical thing would be to force the bondholders to take the haircut. The banks are the bondholders. They would have a banking crisis. So they have no way out other than to take this move that I think we haven't talked about, but is probably the most serious thing that's happened in the last 48 hours. The European Central Bank has now been politicized. The European Central Bank is now buying sovereign debt and buying it aggressively, and that's different. We suddenly now have a whole new ballgame, and that's the implications for the euro are quite serious.
Explain what you mean when you say that the Central European Bank has become political.
Well, if you go back to the 1990s, the Bank of Japan, when the Japan started to enter its slump, began the government ran huge deficits and started to build up debt. The Bank of Japan bought the government debt. They bought the 10-year bonds, and they bought so much of it that it just began piling up everywhere. I mean, it was pretty amazing. Now, in the last year, the Bank of England, again, huge deficits in debt, bought 85% of the British government's debt. The European Central Bank said, we'll never do that. And now they're doing it. So we are entering an era right now that is pretty scary, because what does it mean to have the industrialized world's central banks load up, just buy the sovereign debt? I mean, and just put it on its balance sheets. Is that going to lead to inflation? Is it going to lead to deflation? I don't think we know.
Domenico, are you equally as pessimistic as you hear both Simon and David?
Clearly, this is a defining moment for the euro. The crisis that Europe imported from the U.S. has exposed the deep flaws in the institutional architecture of the euro itself. Essentially, these countries were already growing at a very low rate, and clearly the recent crisis has determined a further slowdown in their growth rates, has induced these countries to increase their fiscal deficits, and through that, their already huge pile of public debt. So all in all, financial markets have reassessed the increased vulnerability of many European economies, not all. But as it was being pointed out before, this vulnerabilities also lie in the absence of a truly economic union in the euro area. So you have a monetary union, you have a European Central Bank, you have a single currency, but there is no economic union because essentially all these sovereign states have been running their own economic policies, except the monetary policy, on account of their own domestic needs, without considering the stability of the euro area economy as a whole. And in fact, the case was being pointed out that, in the euro area, you have a situation that in a way resembles to that of the US and China, in the sense that Germany, even at the height of the recent financial crisis, was running a sizable current account surplus. And this current account surplus was being matched by fiscally profligated countries such as Greece, Portugal, Spain, who were essentially buying, German exports, and Italy as well. And therefore, this really highlights the lack of coordination at the central level in running sustainable economic policies for the area as a whole. Now, David was pointing out also to the issue of the European Central Bank. I mean, certainly what the European Central Bank is being doing as we speak is at the very least unconventional, but it should be framed also in the context of the very critical days that we are going through. So to what extent you can run an independent monetary policy in a context of deep financial instability is a question that no one is really able to answer. And I think in Frankfurt, they are just trying, to fix the holes as best as they can. Clearly, the European policymakers will need to come forward with more convincing answers in the days, weeks, months that lie in front of us. And really, the measures, although exceptional, that were announced on Sunday are more a cure for the symptoms of this European crisis. And they do not address the root causes. The root causes are the need for increasing the potential growth of the euro area, are the need of running, on the whole, fiscally sustainable policies, and strengthening also banking regulations so that the banks' balance sheets are not a source of financial instability, as we have seen throughout these months. And just, you know, in a way, the fiscal deficit that Greece was running last year is of the same order of magnitude of the United States. And yes, no one wonders, no one even for one second doubts that the U.S. is going to find itself in a position similar to Greece. And this is exactly for the reasons that I was listing before for the euro area. It has a very high rate of potential growth, strong currency on which it has full sovereignty, and is a central fiscal policy.
Domenico Lombardi, he is with the Brookings Institution. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers waiting. Want to open the phones here, 800-433-8850. And first to Bruce in Marblehead, Massachusetts. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning,
sir. Let me first compliment you on one of the most intelligent programs on daytime radio.
Thank you.
I never fail to listen to it if I'm awake and moving.
Thank you.
I am a senior citizen. I'm over 70. I live on my Social Security alone. I don't understand markets, and I feel like a pawn whenever anyone says global economy. My question to everyone who has been giving very, very informed but quizzical opinions today is, what do we mean any longer by money as us people who spend it and hopefully have some think of money? Second, does the term loan any longer have any meaning when we're dealing with mega economies? When can it ever be paid back? How is it paid back? Does it simply get written off on an accounting sheet? Like everybody else who's wondering what happens to the United States, a mega, mega economy, I don't have any answers, and I haven't heard any so far.
Thanks for calling, Bruce. David Smick.
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I mean, can you take all the world's debt and put it off balance sheet into a giant pile and then just ignore it? What does that mean? What does it mean from the standpoint of the future prices? We haven't figured that out yet. It's really disconcerting. And I would add just to one other point to our earlier discussion, you know, we need to think about the foreign exchange, the exchange implications of what's going on. Is there the chance for a currency war? For example, the U.S. Treasury has been, you know, struggling with the Chinese to get them to appreciate their currency. And the, you know, the Chinese have been pegged to the dollar, and we are pushing and pushing and pushing. But now the Chinese look at one of their major trading partners, the Europeans, and they say, well, the way things are going in Europe, the Europe is going to weaken dramatically against the dollar. And because we're pegged to the dollar, it will weaken against us, and we will be put at a trade disadvantage. So what do the Chinese do? Do they give Tim Geithner what he wants, or do they, ride down with the Europeans? And, of course, you know, there's this myth that the world's still tied to the dollar. Most of the developing world is tied to the Chinese currency. So what will they do, and what are the implications for financial markets? I guess my bottom line is this is a Rubik's Cube, and we haven't yet figured out where this is all going. As Domenico said, a crucial time right now.
Domenico.
Yes, clearly this is not about Greece anymore, and it may be not about the euro area only, but this is this has the potential really for something bigger than a European crisis. The Bank of Japan was injecting $20 billion yesterday to prop up the money markets. The Chinese are becoming increasingly worried, and the U.S. economy may be hit by this crisis in Europe. There are various channels through which the U.S. economy can be affected. Well, first, Europe is the main trading partner of the U.S. economy, so if Europe doesn't do well, then the U.S. manufacturers may be exporting less to the Europeans. And clearly, in a context where the U.S. recovery is rebounding but is still fragile, this may be a further vulnerability. And also there is another factor to take into consideration, and that is the U.S. does not really compete with China, but it competes with Europe, with Japan, as far as the production of and the exports of capital goods are concerned. And because we expect a weak euro in the coming months, clearly German capital goods exports are going to benefit. And this may create a problem for some U.S. manufacturers.
All right. We'll take a short break. When we come back, more of your comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, constantcontact.com. This is NPR.
Her mother was a guerrilla soldier. Her father led a pro-democracy movement. A young woman in exile from Myanmar recounts her struggle for freedom and survival in Burma. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're talking about the European debt crisis, the fact that the banks have come up with nearly $1 trillion. Here's an email from Matt, who says, I'm currently living and working in Spain, and I'm getting worried. Is there much risk of my losing a lot of my savings from euro devaluation, of Spanish banks failing, or of Spain defaulting on loans? What happens if Spain does default on loans? Does the country fall into chaos? Is it time to quit my job, take my money, and come back to the United States? Simon Tilford.
If you're very cautious, it might be the moment to transfer your savings into a euro account in Germany or the Netherlands. I think the challenges facing Spain are quite formidable. The country doesn't have as much public debt as Greece does, but it has a huge amount of private sector debt. And investors are very worried that it won't be able to grow, or the economy, the Spanish economy, won't be able to grow sufficiently quickly to ensure that private sector debt burden is manageable, and that if it isn't, we will see problems in the Spanish banks, bankruptcies, mass bankruptcies among Spanish companies, and that that will ultimately lead to a steep rise in the amount of public debt. So they're worried about the sort of indirect liabilities that the Spanish government faces in these highly indebted banks and other corporates. They're right to be worried because Spain, there is no obvious way back to robust or even decent economic growth in Spain. Clearly, there are some things the Spanish can do and haven't done. They need to make their labor market more flexible. They need to try and increase productivity growth. But they also need much stronger exports. And it's difficult to see how they're going to bring those about for the reasons we discussed earlier. It's interesting in terms of the sort of imbalances discussion that we were talking about earlier. In many ways, the Eurozone is a sort of microcosm of the broader global rebalancing issue that we have. Whereas we need, in order for the U.S. to rebalance, we need much stronger consumption in East Asia. We need economies there to acknowledge that if one country runs a big surplus, another country has to run a big deficit, and that over time, that becomes unsustainable. Countries cannot run huge deficits indefinitely. Within the Eurozone, we have a similar situation. We have one group of economies running big surpluses and other running deficits, and that issue needs to be addressed. All Unless those imbalances are addressed, Spain is going to have a very difficult time growing out of this situation. It's going to have a very difficult time making its private sector debts and hence its public sector liabilities sustainable, its overall debt position sustainable.
All right. Let's go now to San Antonio, Texas, and to George. Good morning to you, George.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, surely can.
Thanks. My roots are back in Greece, and I was a little upset with the media's banging up on Greece because of the fact if you saw all those rioters, they all had a red flag in their hand. The other thing is Goldman Sachs went to Greece, and Greece paid them $300 million, and Goldman Sachs showed how to do this. Now, it looks like the banks have gone all over Europe and given them a huge credit card, and the people that got the credit card are like the people in the United States. They don't know how to do this. Everything that's happened in Europe, if you know economic history, it's happened before. And why do the best and the brightest never learn? It's greed, I think.
David Smith.
Well, I agree with you. And I think, you know, one of the investigations that's going to unfold in Europe is to what extent did German and French, particularly German companies, Siemens and others, what was their involvement in Greece, particularly during the former regime, which, there was a certain amount of payoffs and all the rest. I mean, to what extent were the Greeks taken advantage of? Now, I'm not saying they're total victims here, but there was a certain sense of they were a playground for the large corporate interests, particularly in Europe, and not to mention Goldman. So I think that's going to be the next part of this story.
All right. And to Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, Diane. Longtime listener. Good topic. I'm curious about the fact is, doesn't the root of all this lie in the fact of fractional reserve banking, money being created out of thin air since the times of Italy in the 1400s? And do you think there'll be a second Bretton Woods and there'll be any redistribution of some of the wealth by the countries that may have taken advantage of the other?
What do you think of that, Simon Tilford?
I certainly think we've seen some very destabilizing flows of money. I mean, if we look at Greece, Portugal, Spain, there's no doubt they've made mistakes. No doubt their governments have made policy mistakes. But at the same time, we saw massive flows of very cheap money from countries that have excess savings, that have big trade surpluses, such as Germany, China, into these markets. So capital was basically free in that real interest rates, i.e. adjusted for inflation, were negative. So basically borrowing capital was very, very easy, and there was plenty of it to borrow. This pumped up the value of all kinds of assets. And then suddenly the inflow of capital was cut off. Now that basically flawed these economies and forced their governments to step in and spend lots of money to prevent them imploding. Now, there's no doubt that they made mistakes, but there are broader issues at play. I mean, within the Eurozone, there are question marks over whether this is really whether the Eurozone fulfills the criteria for a successful currency union.
And that, by the way, that's a global problem, too. I mean,
yeah.
Domenico.
Yeah, this really highlights that, the increased economic and financial globalization that we have observed in the latest few decades has not really been matched by a strengthened global governance or a strengthened institutional framework at the international level in terms of how to really govern or how to manage this very intense globalization.
So what you're saying is the euro was created. There is a central bank, but the political guidance is not there.
This is true at the euro area level. This is also true at the global level, in a way, because here we are in Washington discussing about the possible ramification of the crisis in a country that only accounts for 2% of the euro area GDP. And we're talking about ramifications from this crisis to the U.S. economy, the largest economy in the world. This really shows how globalized is the global economy today. And at the same time, there hasn't been enough progress in terms of coordinating at the global level to make sure that this increased globalization is matched by a stronger institutional framework.
Okay, so you are all speaking fairly, theoretically. And what our listeners want to know is, what does this mean for them, wherever they are, whether they're here in the United States, whether they're in Greece, whether they're in Spain, whether they're in Iceland?
Well,
David Smith.
You had mentioned a minute ago Bretton Woods, and I think it's very interesting because we do not have the political leadership or the leadership in general around the world to move in that direction, because if we did, we would look and say, what is the fundamental reason that the world's in this mess? I mean, I can give you all, it's a perfect storm of reasons, but what was the most important? Global savings imbalances, which led to the underpricing of financial risk, the underpricing of financial risk in Greece, the underpricing of financial risk in U.S. housing, in Spanish housing. And yet, when you go to the various players, if you go to the Chinese or the Germans, for example, who are major exporters, and then they recycle, particularly the Chinese, and that leads to the underpricing of risk, particularly because they buy our debt. They say, we cannot change. We're aging economies. We aging demographics. We cannot. We're going to be exporters, they're waiting for the U.S. consumer to step forward so they can resume again the same system that got us where we are today. And that's really quite insane when you look back and you think, all the efforts now, we're going to have legislation on bank regulation, bailouts. The Europeans are going through it all. But no one's saying, but what about that fundamental thing, which is we can't get the world's economies together and to have a realistic rebalancing. And
here's an email from Jim, who says, would a unified worldwide currency do anything to even out the problems in the various economies, Domenico?
Well, if anything, what we are learning from the current European crisis is just the opposite, that you do want to preserve some room for maneuvering. You do want to have the possibility of devalue your currency if you're hit by a shock.
But Greece cannot do that because it's left the drachma. It's part of the euro.
Absolutely. And this is why clearly having, a world currency would be a very bad idea because, as David was pointing out, world leaders have already a problem in talking about, how to coordinate their economic policies, let alone, managing a world currency.
The problem, too, just real quickly, is that with the Europeans, the Mediterranean countries and Ireland, they have the narcotic of low German interest rates that when they're inside the system, And if they go outside the system, then they face much higher interest rates. So they love the low German interest rates. The problem is they got to compete with Germany, and which is very, very difficult.
All right, let's go to Greensboro, North Carolina. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning. My question is kind of a follow-up to the caller Lynn's question, which is when the year before last, when the U.S. did the bank bailout, there was a lot of uproar from everyday people in saying that the U.S. government was basically transferring wealth from the middle class and lower to the wealthiest people because of the mistakes they made. And however, for this EU, the bailout for Greece, what I'm hearing on the news is that they're bailing out governments who are socializing their health care, their workers' retirement, things that we normally think of as the middle class. So I'd like for the guests to talk about that. Is there a difference as far as the government, the U.S. government and other governments' role in the redistribution of wealth, the transfer of wealth from the wealthiest to the middle class or vice versa?
Simon Tilford.
I think this raises a very interesting issue, and it was one touched on by David a few minutes ago. Which is namely that the adjustment that has to be made in these economies now in Greece and Spain and Portugal is going to fall almost exclusively on labour, on the working person who's going to have to take big cuts in wages, who's going to see big cuts in public services, etc. Yet the problem has largely arisen because of the poor pricing of risk and of huge capital inflows. Basically, financial institutions made very poor lending decisions. So the banks, basically, in Europe will be bailed out one way or another because the governments are fearful of a collapse in the banking sector and the impact that would have, obviously, on the broader economy. But that basically means that we're going to see a further transfer of wealth to people who have basically been guilty of very poor lending decisions. And that, I think, politically is going to pose a big challenge in Europe. I don't think the kind of austerity that is going to be needed in these economies will prove politically sustainable, particularly given the fact we've already seen a massive transfer of resources to the banking sector.
Simon Tilford,
now we're going to see a further transfer through this crisis.
Simon Tilford is chief economist at the Center for European Reform. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go to Rockford, Illinois. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Diane. I live, as you said, in Illinois, and we have a yearly deficit of $13 billion this year and an overall debt, the state of Illinois, of about $129 billion. We are a state of the United States kind of comparable to Greece in the European Union, and as they're just throwing this out there, the debt, the individual states in the United States are in very poor fiscal shape, and they're talking about budget cutbacks that would be, you know, just hard to do in Illinois. So I guess, is that the next shoe to drop here?
David Smith, well, I think that's already happening.
That's already happening.
Not?
And, you know, the big issue, of course, is pension reform. The numbers are so mind-boggling. You don't know how they're going to be able to do that. I watched the television last week and, you know, watching the Greek public sector workers rioting, and I kept thinking, this is going to be us because the public can't afford to meet the pension obligations, and yet, you know, these people have been promised this. And so you're going to, you know, I saw.
I think you should be clear about differentiating between Greece's retirement age at 55
right.
with full employed pension
right.
versus this country 65, which perhaps could tweak to 67. I mean, you've got enormous differences there. I surely hope we are not going to see rioting in the streets, but do you really believe that could be possible?
I when I look at the sheer size of the numbers, not the state budget deficits, the off-balance sheet pension obligations, I don't know how you meet that. I mean, when you're talking tens and tens of trillions of dollars for these states, it's so far beyond their thing. Now, there's going to have to be reforms, and that's going to be very painful because state workers say, look, I left the private sector, I took this job in part because I knew I was going to get the reforms. But you've seen the comparisons in California where essentially you have someone at $60,000, you know, supporting the state worker at 110 when you factor in the retirement benefits. And even if the numbers are off, it's a huge political problem for the next round of leadership.
Well, it sounds to me as though you are all fairly pessimistic. Somehow, though, this country has managed to come through, and I suspect eventually the world will as well. David Smick, he's chairman of macroeconomic advisory firm and the editor of the International Economy magazine, author of the book The World is Curved. Domenico Lombardi, he's with the Brookings Institution, and Simon Tilford at the Center for European Reform. Thank you all so much. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.